Well, labor relations have certainly been in the news lately. And on the show today, we'll talk about what you need to know. I'm Jill Nadeau, and this is The Larry Mueller Show. We're welcoming labor and employment attorney Michael Kent to the show. Mike has taught employment law and labor relations at Madison Area Technical College for 20 years now. Are you wondering how all these changes will affect you? Do you have questions about your rights as an employee or an employer? We want to hear from you, so give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And just a reminder, our discussion today is intended as general information and should not be relied on or construed as legal advice. Mike, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
So I would imagine it's kind of busy for people who are in any kind of employment law. I mean, there have been so many changes in just the last 2 weeks.
Yes, there have. It's a little bit dizzying to keep track of it. In addition to the executive orders that are being issued, then there's the various responses to executive orders. So some of these orders end up getting enjoined. Other ones are being challenged through other means, and it's an exciting time to be an employment attorney.
That's one way to put it. Very positive outlook. Well, let's just take a look at what's been going on in Washington. What are these deferred resignations all about?
Okay, so the deferred resignation offer that's been in the news recently, it was given to some federal employees on January 28th, and it essentially told them that we're giving you the option to resign from your position, but with a deferred applicability date. And that deferred date, I believe, is September 30th of this year. And if you accept this deferred resignation offer, then we will not make you return to work. There's the backdrop against which this offer was made is that there is a lot of talk right now about ending telework and remote work for federal employees, requiring them to return to work in person at their headquarters offices. There's been some conversation about relocating some of the headquarters offices of a number of different federal agencies. Then there's been additional talk about shrinking the size of the federal workforce and reclassifying a number of federal employees from their current classification in the civil service to positions that don't have the same kinds of protections. So there's a lot of change on the horizon. And so against that backdrop, this email was sent out, and employees were given until this week, I think it's February 6th, to decide whether or not they wanted to accept this agreement.
How is that different from a buyout, Mike?
Okay, so the exact offer that's included with this agreement is a little bit uncertain. What the email itself says is that if you accept this deferred resignation offer, you don't have to comply with the return to work rules, and you will be exempted from any workforce cuts between now and the time of your the effective date of your resignation. The FAQs that have appeared on the Office of Personnel Management's website sort of characterize it differently. There's some suggestion that employees who accept the offer don't have to report to work at all if they want to. They can, you know, essentially they're getting a paid vacation. And so there's a little bit of inconsistency about what the exact nature of the offer is. And then there have been some concerns noted by different players, including the American Federation of Governmental Employees has noted that, you know, if this is a buyout offer, then it's one that probably exceeds the president's authority under the law. Under the civil service regulations, a buyout offer cannot be in excess of $25,000. And for a lot of employees, if it was really the case that they just got to stay home from work, then the value of that buyout would be substantially in excess of $25,000. And so in response to that, the Office of Personnel Management said that, well, we're going to look at putting people onto paid administrative leave for that period. Not necessarily that they have to do that. That's another element of the buyout offer was, or the, not the buyout offer, the deferred resignation offer. I want to make sure I get my terminology right. Correct there. was that your job duties may be distributed to other employees. They may be changed. You may be asked to help train a replacement or train people on how to do your work. So there's a lot of caveats that are in there. So as soon as they said, well, we're just going to we'll put people on paid administrative leave, then somebody brought up, well, but the Administrative Leave Act limits paid administrative leave to 10 days in any calendar year. So you can't really put these employees on paid administrative leave either. The other concern that's been brought up is because the government is currently operating under a continuing resolution we don't necessarily know whether or not this deferred resignation program will end up being funded when Congress comes back together to do either another continuing resolution or some other budget action in March. So there isn't really a guarantee that there will be money available to pay for the program one way or the other. So right now there's a lot of uncertainty about exactly how this would work. And also what exactly the offer is. That's kind of the situation on the ground as of today on this offer.
That may change. You just never know.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So if someone came to you and they were a federal employee, what would you advise them to do?
Ooh, well, here's maybe another aspect of this that is worth noting. The president's office indicated that they anticipate that maybe 5 to 10% of the federal workforce will take advantage of this offer, and that would be a meaningful number of people. There's roughly 2 million federal employees in the federal civil service that received this offer. The total federal workforce, by the way, is somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 million, give or take. The federal civil service is just one of five different groups that are all considered government employees. So there's the civil service, there's the military, there's the post office, then there's contract workers, and there's grant workers. And so of the total, 10 or 11 million federal employees, only roughly 2 million are in the civil service and are impacted by this notice. But among those 2 million employees, the Office of Personnel Management indicates that every year they hire between 200 and 300,000 employees, which means that the normal turnover rate within the federal civil service is roughly 10%. So if you were one of those employees who was going to retire anyway or was otherwise thinking of leaving, go for it. No, uh-huh. No harm here. If you are, however, somebody that would like to keep your job and was anticipating continuing employment, I would say that until the questions are answered about it, I would be reluctant to accept it. Now, if they clarify it, and they make more firm representations in the offer itself, then something for someone to consider. But right now, the uncertainty means that you kind of don't know what you're actually getting in exchange for your resignation, and so that for that reason, I would urge caution.
Okay, well, that seems fair. How are state employees affected by this? Because I know this is for federal employees, right?
That's correct. So this does not. There are potentially in the future, if they pursue workforce reduction actions among the grant or contract sections of the workforce, then you could potentially start to see some people who work for the state impacted, ones that are funded by grant positions or funded by contracts. So that would really be the only way that that would start to impact state employees. For the time being, this offer and the various things that arise around this offer really only strictly apply to federal employees, and then more specifically federal employees in the federal civil service.
Okay. And do the federal civil servant group, do they have a union? Is this, and if so, how is the union reacting to this?
Well, the union's not thrilled.
Well, gee, I wonder why.
Yes. The biggest federal union, I might have mentioned before, is the American Federation of Governmental Employees. They have about 800,000 members. They include members of the federal civil service. They also include some employees in Washington, D.C., but they've advised their members not to accept the offer. There are other large unions representing federal employees as well, and they are also resisting the buyout offer. What's been reported actually is that they're saying it's having the effect of galvanizing employees against leaving. So I don't know how that will end up playing out. At least, well, two major federal employee unions have already filed lawsuits against some of the other executive orders that have come out, notably the one impacting the reclassification of federal employees into what's called Schedule F. So within the federal civil service, there's different levels of job security. There's different levels of job protection. If you are in the normal competitive service or in the merit service, then you can only be dismissed for cause. There are certain due process protections that apply. You have certain property interests, constitutionally protected property interests in your job. So there's much more job security, much more certainty about your continued employment if you're a member of the regular civil service. If you move into one of these policy-related positions, then those positions really serve at the pleasure of the president. And so you're much more like an employee at will. In those circumstances, you have less protection against being released for, well, any reason or no reason as soon as your services are no longer desired by the president, then you can be released and you don't have the same kind of due process protections.
Well, we are talking with Michael Kent, a labor and employment attorney, and for 20 years he's taught employment law and labor relations at Madison Area Technical College. We're talking right now about some of the new employee regulations coming out of Washington, but if you have questions about your employment or as an employee, please give us a call. The lines are open, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is a Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najel. I hope you can stay with us. Coming up at noon, we're going to change topics quite a bit and talk about shipwrecks on the Great Lakes and the upcoming Ghost Ships Festival in Manitowoc. But right now, we are talking about employee and employer law. Employment law, I guess, is the term, right, Mike?
Yes.
Well, Stacy emailed to say that they are a physician and the largest healthcare company in Madison, I'm assuming at. Stacy has two questions. Stacy said they do not get a protected break to use the bathroom or eat during their work day, and everyone else in the office takes mandated breaks while the MD has no break and keeps seeing patients. Is this legal? And then question number two, our MD compensation plan has changed from hourly to salary. If we don't work our contracted hours, say the individual were sick with COVID and missed a few days, the healthcare company employer asks that the MD either pick up shifts to make up for the days away for illness, or the employer takes money out of the paycheck. I was told by my employer that they are allowed to do this because of the MD's professional status. She said if a teacher calls in, they don't have money taken out of their paycheck. Is this legal? Lots of stuff there, Mike.
There's a lot to unpack.
Yeah.
So let me, I'll first touch on what I can remember of the first question, and that is with respect to the ability to take restroom breaks and other breaks. So there is no federal law that requires any particular number of breaks during any shift. There is also no law in Wisconsin for adult workers that requires your employer to give you really any kind of a break. There is a recommendation that if an employee works more than 6 hours, that they receive at least a 30-minute lunch break, but there isn't like a minimum number of breaks that an employee is entitled to during the workday. Now, there's a caveat on that for purposes of bathroom breaks, because there are regulations through OSHA, and I'm sorry, I didn't catch whether this employee works for a public employer or a private employer. If it's a public employer, then there's state regulations that would apply. If it's a private employer, then the OSHA regulations would likely apply. And there are OSHA regulations regarding allowing workers to take restroom breaks. So if you're being denied the opportunity to use the restroom at all, that would probably be worth talking to someone about, another employment attorney. I can't advise you specifically about your issue here, and it wouldn't be ethically responsible for me to do so based on just the content of a sure. telephone call. But there are some rules that may apply to that situation, at least. With respect to the equity of breaks throughout the office, there isn't a requirement that your employer treat all employees the same with respect to the breaks it gives, unless the you're being treated differently based on some sort of protected classification. So if they let all the men take breaks, but they don't let the women take breaks, for example, or if there's some other potentially discriminatory effect taking place, then, you know, again, there could be a legal impact. Otherwise, again, your employer, if you're unless you're working under some sort of employment contract, there's no rule about treating everyone the same. So the second question, again, to the extent that I can recall, it had to do with an employer withholding pay for days not worked for a salaried employee. And that's an interesting question that has come up a couple of times in the context of my professional practice here. And so in order to qualify as a FLISA-exempt employee, meaning that you don't have to be paid overtime if you work for more than 40 hours a week, among the requirements that they have statutory exemptions for certain types of employee. So doctors, you mentioned, there's teachers, other types of professionals, there's managerial employees, confidential administrative employees can all fall under one of the statutory exemptions that allow a person to be exempted from the right to overtime. But in order to be what's called a FLISA-exempt employee, you have to be paid on a salaried basis. So being paid on a salaried basis, what that means is that you get paid the same amount of money each week, irrespective of the number of hours that you work. So if you're a true salary basis employee you make, whatever, let's call it $5,000 a week, that's a lot, but $5,000 a week, you get paid that $5,000 a week, whether you work 40 hours a week, whether you work 60 hours a week, or whether you work 30 hours a week. There are some limited exceptions for when an employee misses an entire day, and it's subject to a paid time off benefit plan. But that's the thing that kind of stuck out to me when you were describing that situation, is that are these people really being treated as salary basis employees under these circumstances?
She did say that that they were contracted hours. So could that be something in their contract that she signed that would say that if you are sick and don't fulfill the hours that we require of you, we can take money away from you?
Well, yeah, I mean, then I'd have to look at the contract itself. So And maybe I misheard because I got stuck focusing
no,
on the positions.
Yeah.
But if you're an hourly employee, then you're generally not entitled to be paid for hours that you don't work. And so if your contract is set up on an hourly basis.
And she's is salary at this point. It was hourly, now it's switched to salary. And so she said, if we don't work our contracted hours, say they missed days because they were sick, the company asks the doctors to either pick up shifts or make up for the days away for illness, or the employer will take money out of their paycheck.
Yeah. So that's, you're dancing around whether or not you're actually salary based at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So that situation is going to be involved enough, and it's going to require a careful reading of the contract. You probably need to talk to an attorney in their office and let them review the language of the contract to see exactly what's going on there.
Definitely. Well, good luck, Stacy, and thank you for the email. If you've got a question for Mike, you can give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email talk@wpr.org. So one of the other executive orders is the basically, they're dismantling all of the federal government's DEI programs. And just so you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion is what the DEI stands for. How's this being done, Mike?
So that was there have been a couple of executive orders on that topic. One of them is essentially an internal memo directing all the federal agencies to dismantle the DEI programs they have within the agency. The one that's probably the more substantive one is the one titled Ending Illegal Discrimination and Restoring Merit-Based Opportunity. Now, that one, that's a doozy. Of the executive orders that have been filed so far, that one is probably, I want to say, well, it's hard to compare it to some of the ones impacting immigration, but from an employment perspective, that one is really big. And it did a couple of things. The one that's most relevant to non-federal employees is that it rescinded Executive Order 11246. Now, Executive Order 11246 has been in effect since the 1960s, and it has the requirement that anybody that is working on a federal contract or receiving money from the federal government through a contract has to maintain an affirmative action plan, specifically with respect to race, color, religion, and sex. So the rescission of Executive Order 11246 means that now federal contractors are no longer required to track applicants with respect to their demographic information. They're no longer required to prepare an annual affirmative action plan. And there are other elements of that executive order that are actually even more impactful than that. Now, this is one that we've spent an awful lot of time looking at and talking about. And among the reasons for it is that so the federal affirmative action requirements, they do include race, color, religion, sex, but they also include categories such as veteran status and disability status. Now, the requirements to maintain an affirmative action plan for disability status, that's a different law. That's Section 503 of the Rehabilitation Act. And then the requirement to maintain an affirmative action plan for veterans is under VEVRA, the Vietnam-era Veterans Readjustment Act. All these public employers and federal contractors that had been maintaining these more expansive affirmative action plans now are still obligated to maintain affirmative action plans for disability and veterans, but are not required to maintain them for race and color and sex. The thing that makes this challenging, or at least just that aspect of the executive order, is that there's still a legal requirement to avoid disparate impact discrimination. So discrimination in employment can take two forms. There's disparate treatment and there's disparate impact. Disparate treatment is when a guy comes and hands me a job application and I say, I'm not going to hire you because you're black. That's disparate treatment. It's plainly illegal. It was made illegal under the McDonnell Douglas versus Green decision of the Supreme Court issued shortly after the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed. Disparate impact discrimination is when I don't tell you directly that I'm not hiring you because you're a black person. It's instead I use some other measure that has the effect of discriminating against black people. So in the case that gave rise to it, Griggs v. Duke Power, Duke Power had a employment requirement that if you didn't have a high school diploma, you could never do anything other than work in their labor department, which was the lowest paying department in the power plant they were operating. And so at the time, not very many black people had a high school diploma. And so it had the effect of keeping black people out of the better paying jobs. And when this case was brought to court, it came out that, well, there isn't really anything about these higher paying jobs that really requires a high school diploma. You can do those jobs without having one. And so the high school diploma requirement really was just having the effect of keeping black people out of those better paying jobs. And so it was ruled to be illegal. And that's what became known as disparate impact discrimination. So that's the law of the land, and it's still the law of the land. So if you have a hiring practice that has the effect of screening out more black people than other demographic groups, for example, that's still illegal. That's still actionable. By eliminating the affirmative action requirement, companies now they're not required to keep track of whether or not not required to affirmatively keep track of whether or not their hiring practices are having a discriminatory effect, they're still on the hook for it. So a lot of companies and contractors still have an interest in monitoring their hiring practices, their promotion practices, their pay practice to make sure they're not creating that disparate impact because they're still on the hook for that. And the element of the Civil Rights Act, it's Title VI of the Civil Rights Act that requires federal contractors to not discriminate. Well, there's language in the regulations that still require that you can't use any sort of screening process or hiring that has the effect of discrimination based on race, color, national origin, et cetera. So the rules are still there, but the mechanism for making sure you're following them is really there. Kind of what went away.
Oh,
so.
My gosh. Oh, okay. Well, let's go to a different topic here. We've got Callie and Madison with a question. Go ahead, Callie.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was calling just to ask about a non-disclosure agreement that I chose to sign once I was fired from a nonprofit a year ago. I'm just wondering, because now I kind of wish I hadn't signed it, just because it, I think the agreement itself is about 6 pages. It's just, it's so all-inclusive that it feels like I would never be able to even mention this company's name, not that I want to, and I certainly don't have an interest in disparaging it, but I made the choice to sign it, and I'm just wondering, it seems like it's forever, but is there any way to get out of a non-disclosure agreement? What are your recommendations, or is it just it is what it is?
So I'm gonna lump the non-disclosure agreement in with another type of typical agreement that people sign when they're leaving an employer, and that's a non-compete agreement as well. And non-compete agreements recently have sort of come into disfavor in the court, that the courts have shown a willingness to limit them really to only the minimum that is necessary to protect the legitimate business interests of the company. And so if you draft a non-compete agreement that's too expansive, then you run the risk that the court's not going to uphold it. Now, in the case of a non-disclosure agreement, well, that's a contract between you and your employer. There are certain bases upon which a contract can be nullified. If the contract is unconscionable, for example, that could be a basis to void it, or to at least void portions of it. This one is going to be another one where it's really going to depend on the circumstances. It's going to depend on what is the legitimate business interest of the company in the non-disclosure agreement. Does the non-disclosure agreement cross over into any areas of public law? Because that's another thing that courts will look at is, you know, have you agreed not to disclose to the federal government something in a whistleblowing capacity? Because is when you start to cross over into public law, like discrimination protections or whistleblower protections and things like that, then there are other bases upon which to review the contract. And so in order to really provide good advice on this, an attorney would need to know not only, you know, what the job was, what the responsibilities of the job were, what the circumstances were around the departure, and then what the contents are of the non-disclosure agreement to see if any of these potential exceptions apply to it. It's very possible that they don't, but there are some exceptions that exist out there under the law for the enforceability of those kinds of contractual agreements. So, I guess it's worth talking to a lawyer over.
Okay, thank you for that question, Callie. Excuse me. Mike Ted emailed. He said his supervisor wants him to sign a performance improvement plan that he doesn't think is fair. What are his options?
Well, there's a lot of additional information that would probably fall into that. So is the person, are they under an employment contract? Are they a public sector employee or a private sector employee? So a performance improvement plan, where you frequently see those is in work environments where there is some sort of job protection, where the employer may need just cause in order to terminate an employee. And so the performance improvement plan is documentation of a performance deficiency, and it's giving the employee an opportunity to correct the deficiency. And then in the event that the employee doesn't correct the deficiency, then it creates just cause to discipline or terminate the employee. They are not in and of themselves considered to be disciplinary. They are really, they are advising the employee of this is the specific performance disability that is being observed. And a performance improvement plan will also generally include, you know, what are the standards that we're going to expect you to meet in order to cure the deficiency. So a performance improvement plan may say, you know, we've noticed that you come into work, 10 minutes late every day. So that's the identification of the deficiency. It'll then say, you know, to cure this deficiency, you know, you will show up to work on time every day. So they say what success looks like, or what curing the deficiency looks like. In terms of what part of the plan you don't agree with, if you don't agree with the deficiency that's been identified, yeah, that's a little tricky because, ultimately it's your supervisor's evaluation of your performance that's important. If it's just factually inaccurate, that would be something to note. Usually there is an opportunity on a performance improvement plan for the employee to include some sort of a statement. If there's nothing like that on the plan itself, then what I would suggest is write up your concerns about the plan and provide them to your employer in the form of a letter, so that you've documented, you know, these are the concerns that I have about this plan. I think that's probably the best thing that you can do at that point. And if you're an at-will employee, it's going to be tricky, because if you're at-will, your employer can fire you for any reason or no reason, as long as it's not an illegal reason.
Mike, can you explain what an at-will employee is?
Oh, sure. So that's kind of the default state in Wisconsin and elsewhere in the country. An at-will employee means that you don't have a employment contract for any particular term of employment, and that for both the employee and the employer, the duration of the agreement is just as long as you decide to keep it going. So from your employer's perspective, if they've hired you at will, means that if I need you for the next 3 weeks and then I don't need you anymore, I can terminate you at the end of those 3 weeks, and that's it. I haven't violated any contracts, haven't violated any agreements. You can be let go because there's no expectation of continuing employment with an at-will relationship. From the employee's perspective, it means you can quit whenever you want to with no worries that you're going to be accused of breaching a contract or causing some sort of injury to the company. If you decide you want to quit, your employer might say, well, we really want 2 weeks' notice, but if you're at will, you're not legally obligated to provide that. You have the same ability that the employer does to end the relationship whenever.
And I would think that then that is put in front of the employee at the time they are hired, that they are at will.
The default assumption is that you are at will unless you have some other agreement in place. So the opposite of the at will employee is one that has some sort of contractual expectation of continued employment. And usually when you have that sort of contractual expectation, then it will include a provision in it that says you can only be disciplined or discharged for cause, for just cause. This is actually one of the big things that's impacting the federal workers right now, and the attempt to reclassify some of those federal workers from these protected classifications where you can only be disciplined or discharged for cause into positions where that for cause protection doesn't exist. Usually you see that in either a unionized environment. Some professionals have employment contracts, but it's more the exception than the rule. Unless you have an employment contract, then the default assumption is that you're just at will. They don't have to come out and say you're at will.
Okay. All right. Thank you. We are talking with Michael Kent. He's a labor and employment attorney. And for 20 years, Mike has taught employment law and labor relations at Madison Technical College. If you ever got a question for us, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is a Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Tomorrow we're going to talk about chocolates, jewelry, and flowers. And you can join us for this Valentine's tutorial about starting at 11 o'clock on Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now we are talking about employee law. And Mike, we didn't get a chance yet to talk about Title IX. I know that's a big topic too. But just briefly, why don't you tell us what it was struck down just recently. So what does that mean? And what is actually, talk about what Title IX is briefly, and then what it means that it's been struck down.
Well, so the Title IX law itself is still intact. What was struck down recently were some changes to the regulations implementing Title IX. So Title IX, it's the of the Education Amendments Act, is the federal law that says that in educational opportunities, including participation in sports, a school is not allowed to discriminate on the basis of sex. The regulations implementing Title IX include the procedures for conducting an investigation. Additionally, what can constitute sex discrimination under Title IX. And so it's a kind of a big deal for schools in particular. So grade schools, high schools, colleges are all impacted by that. This one has been kind of a ping pong ball. So for a number of years, the Title IX regulations were just kind of set at a status quo. And then during the first Trump administration, the Department of Education rewrote the Title IX regulations. And what they did is they somewhat changed the definition of what constituted discrimination. They added different requirements with respect to the investigation procedure, the hearing procedure, things like the right to face-to-face cross-examination of witnesses and things like that. So that became the law, or that became the binding regulations as of 2020. Then the Biden administration, during its tenure, again revised the regulations to Title IX. And so they once again updated them, and they made some additional changes. And among the changes that they proposed for the 2024 versions, one is it expanded the definition of sex for purposes of sex-based harassment to include gender identity and sexual orientation. That's consistent with the Bostock decision that came down a couple of years back here. It expanded the ability to engage in informal resolution. It changed the definition of what constituted harassment, and it added protections for pregnant students. Now, I think it was primarily the inclusion of the protections based on gender identity that I think drew the challenges. And so shortly after those regulations were released, they were challenged in court, and they ended up being frozen. Court issued injunctions in a number of states. Ultimately, a court issued an injunction that covered a good portion of the colleges in the University of Wisconsin system. And so that update was somewhat frozen. Now, after the election, another court ruled on the 2024 regulations, and it just it struck them down nationwide. And because the change in the administration, it's unlikely that the administration will continue to defend the 2024 rules, so they'll just go back to the 2020 rules. But one of the most substantial differences, besides the inclusion or exclusion of sexual orientation, gender identity, and pregnant students, is the definition of what constitutes sexual harassment. The old rules said that it's conduct that is sufficiently severe or pervasive so as to meaningfully disrupt an individual's ability to participate in the educational institution. So the 2020 rules kind of raised the bar on that, that instead of it being either severe or pervasive, now it has to be severe and pervasive and objectively offensive. So it's if you have a very severe incident under the old rules, one severe incident could rise to the level of sexual harassment. But under the new rules, severity by itself doesn't meet the test. It also has to be pervasive. It also has to be objectively offensive. And that was something that was then changed back again in the 2024 rules. But now that those rules have been struck down, we're back to the 2020 rules, which are a higher burden to meet if you're a complainant for Title IX.
And who ultimately decides that? The court?
Who decides if a Title IX complaint is made?
Yeah.
So when a Title IX complaint is made, it's an administrative process. It has to be investigated by the institution. Then the institution, if it ends up going to hearing, it actually goes before a hearing examiner, an independent hearing examiner. Ultimately, if somebody really disagrees with the outcome, it can be appealed to a court of law. But in terms of if you were talking about the regulations, who decides which regulations are going to be in effect, that has been determined by the court at this point. So.
Okay. We did get a call from Roberto in Hilbert. He couldn't stay with us, but he said that recently he started a new job and was asked to sign a document about the need for personal protective equipment. But then he was informed that he, as an employee, needed to buy or provide that equipment on their own. Roberto is wondering why he should have to pay for PPE for a job that requires it.
Okay. Well, that's a very good question. This is another one of these employee at will versus employee on a employment contract differences. So the employer is required under OSHA to require PPE for certain circumstances. They are not in many cases required to provide it. They're merely required to ensure that it's being used. So like steel-toed shoes, for example, a very common example. There are a lot of jobs that require steel-toed shoes, and a lot of employers require their employees to buy them on their own. Now, a number of jobs will give you a stipend for that. For example, they'll they'll say, we'll give you like $100 every 2 years to get steel-toed boots. And you know, if you end up having to buy it yourself, it's technically tax deductible, but it usually doesn't add up to very much. There are going to be other circumstances where the PPE is probably sufficient or rather expensive or technical enough that there's really no choice but for the employer to provide it. But my guess is that in this case, it's something like safety glasses or safety shoes. And for that, again, this is the difference between an at-will work environment versus a unionized work environment. If you were in a unionized work environment, that sort of thing is very commonly found in union contracts about the employer being responsible for providing the PPE.
Okay. Thanks for that question, Roberto. We've got about 5 minutes left, Mike, and I wanted to talk about the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act that took effect in June. Can you tell us some basics on that one?
Oh, sure. So it's been around fairly recently, and recognizing that there are more and more women in the workplace who get pregnant and then want to continue to work through their pregnancy, it created sort of a light version of the Americans with Disabilities Act. So under the Americans with Disabilities Act, if you have a disability, your employer is obligated to make reasonable accommodations for you, and there's a involved procedure that one might follow for that. So what the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act did is say that if someone has a condition associated with their pregnancy that requires an accommodation, the employer has a similar responsibility to accommodate it. So some of the examples, if you have a pregnant employee who works behind a checkout counter and it's because of her pregnancy, it hurts to stand for 8 hours a day, this employee might request a chair, and now under the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act, the employer is required to provide that accommodation. The ability to take bathroom breaks during the day, the ability to keep a bottle of water at your workstation. So accommodations like that, you don't have to prove that you have a disability, so it doesn't have to interfere with one or more of your major life functions. It really just has to be a known limitation associated with pregnancy. So the limitations associated with pregnancy are fairly well known. And really the only requirement is that the employee inform their employer of the limitation and to request the accommodation. There is a protection against an undue burden. So if you say, well, based on my pregnancy, I need to have a massage chair at my desk. That might be nice, but that might rise to the level of an undue burden.
Sure.
But they might get you a more comfortable regular chair or something to that effect.
Compromise may be made.
Yes, it is a deliberative process. It's a two-way conversation between the employer and the employee to figure out exactly what accommodations need to be made. But that was a nice addition for employees, particularly pregnant employees.
Sure. So the final word, Mike, if someone's having a problem with their employee, what's your best advice for them? They take it to HR? Do they take it further? Or what's the best first step?
The best first step is generally going to be to talk to your HR department. Oftentimes, particularly in small to medium-sized workplaces, the individual managers don't have very much training at all about employment law. They don't have very much training. They don't have very much training about the best practices when it comes to managing employees. And oftentimes, just a talk with the HR department is enough to fix the problem. So that should really be everybody's first step.
Sure. Makes total sense. Well, Mike, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been quite a lesson. I can tell you're a teacher. And thank you for unpacking all this, because it is very confusing. So we'll have you back and we can talk some more. Mike Kent is a labor and employment attorney, and for 20 years he's taught employment law and labor relations at Madison Area Technical College. And just a reminder, our discussion today is intended as general information and should not be relied on or construed as legal advice. Stay with us. We're going to talk about shipwrecks on the Great Lakes.